Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by three very interesting guests. I'd like to welcome Dr. Karen Jacobson, a speaker and high-performance strategist. Karen, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And Jeff Lynch, an attorney with the law offices of Jeffrey D. Lynch. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Thank you, Adrian.
And Barney Davey, publisher and business marketing coach, editor and publisher of Art Marketing News. Welcome, Barney.
Hi, Adrian.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, Karen, I'd like to start with you. You have a very interesting professional career. Not only do you help companies get more value out of people, you inspire folks to live their best, most high-performing life. Tell us a little bit about the work you do and how you serve folks.
It's all because of my grandfather. When I was a little kid, we moved to Israel, and at 6 years old, I would watch my grandfather create rituals in his life to build success. And whenever I had questions about how to, or what is going on, or wanting to understand things, he would strive and really teach me how to learn and how to create and build success in my own life. And that's something that I realized as a child, it doesn't matter what you do and how many times you fall. It's how you get up and what you do afterwards. And that really is a lesson that I took with me throughout my life in all areas. I've translated that into my business and into the work that I do.
Talk about some of the services that you provide. You work with companies in a variety of capacities. What are they?
I have a suite of services that will go from speaking, which might be in conferences or at events. I'll do high-performance team training, and that will include anything from doing assessments. I'm a certified behavior analyst, and I've got some background in linguistics and communication, as well as leadership. So I bring those things to the table and put my slant on them because of my background as a performer, as a dancer, and I bring things to life to be able to not only give didactic information, but also practical experience so that we can take the team, create not only higher performance, but a more cohesive, more collaborative, efficient team.
When most executives think of high performance, they're thinking of business outcomes, productivity, efficiency, results. And you're thinking along those lines, but you're also thinking of performance. You are a performer. Talk a little bit about that background and how that informs the unique take you bring or the unique approach you bring to high performance in companies and teams.
In the past, and I see this trend shifting in business more and more, and people are really talking about high-performance teams and what it takes to lead a high-performance team. In the past, we used to focus a lot on management and being the supervisor or the boss, but that only creates a work group that actually builds competition within the team itself. The idea of having somebody who will lead with a purpose, with a vision, with a mission, is about creating a focal point where the team can build around and all move in the same direction, because we do know, as cliche as it might seem, the word team is that together everyone achieves more. And the aspect of performance comes from your human core skills, not just the practical technical skills that you bring to work, but your ability to connect and relate to other people, your emotional intelligence, your ability to build relationships and lead people.
You are the author of a book, Power Conversations. What are some of the key themes in that book, and how does it help people communicate more effectively in business and in life?
Power Conversations is all about how we relate to other people. It's really starting with the first impression that you create when you walk into a room and just people see your posture, read your posture, see how you look, all the way to building those lasting relationships, which means that when I'm communicating with somebody else, I really have to understand how they communicate in order to create a bridge to them. If I was going to visit a foreign country, it would behoove me to study a little bit about their habits, their language, and in order to become comfortable with who they are in order to relate to them. It's no different when we go into a business and we have people as a variety. We all have different personalities, different cultures, different belief systems, different experiences. And in order to build a bridge and create a connection, we have to understand where they come from, speak their language, and really invite them into our lives.
Culture is the product of conversations, the conversations people have with themselves and about others and about their work environment. And conversations are the basic building block of human communication. It's the way we connect with others, the way we build a shared sense of purpose. How do business leaders today need to communicate differently in order to really connect and inspire the best from their people?
Most of the time, people tend to communicate from their own style of communication, from their own persona. If I am somebody who is really focused on detail, as an example, and I communicate with everyone through detail, I'm going to lose people along the way. Because as individuals, we have different, as you were saying, different focal areas. So if I'm having a conversation with somebody who's more about feeling, and I don't necessarily as a leader have to be touchy-feely, but I have to acknowledge the fact that maybe coming in with a little smile and saying hello, hope you're having a good day, is going to solidify a relationship with somebody who's more of a people person and less of a task and process person, process-oriented person, less of a detailed person. So understanding as a leader and having the ability to adapt to other people is what's going to take somebody further along in their journey as they climb up the leadership ladder.
You work on stage, you work in small groups, you also do a unique form of consulting. We just had in the studio LT Ladino Bryson, founder of vcandidates.com, a new platform to help the recruitment and hiring process suck less. She didn't say it on those terms, but that's essentially what I'll say. And you've done some work with them to help develop unique behavioral profiles and assessments. Can you talk a little bit about some of that work in whatever level of detail is appropriate?
So, and we are in partnership. They are clients as a company. They are clients of mine. And I use my skill set in that source to work with the individuals and provide some behavioral assessment. I'm partnered with a company here actually in town with TTI. And as a certified behavior analyst, I will provide assessments to the individuals, and also should the recruiters themselves also look for potentially job benchmarking, really identifying how to hire properly, they would consult with me. Right now, we started on the, since it's really in launch phase, and it's a really very exciting concept, which is different from other companies in the fact that it's a cross-platform for candidates, employers, and recruiters, where they really have the ability to cross-connect, and there's more of an educational process. These candidates have the opportunity to work with me one-on-one with some executive coaching after they receive their assessment in order to prep themselves, even as individuals, to move further up the ladder and get better jobs along the way.
Human beings are fascinating creatures. We have stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and we're also very much a product of our environment. The research on human behavior points us in the direction that so little of what we do is actually autonomous individual activity. And so much of it is constrained by our own habits, and those habits are a product of the environment. Do companies, beyond giving lip service to culture, pay attention to the nuances of the physical environment and the conversational environment in which people are expected to perform? And if not, what should they do about that?
When you're dealing with companies that are more progressive, that are open, let's say you're looking at Zappos or at Google or at any of the companies that have actually looked at how do we build culture? How do we create purpose? How do we really bring people to the level where they can really maximize their own potential? That's when they're looking at things. There are stories where you're going to find a company that might have, as an example, a nap room. And they use that in order to give incentives to younger generations. And yet that nap room is not necessarily being used. But the fact that it's there gives confidence to an employee that should they be in a position where they need a little shut-eye and time to refresh, they'll have that opportunity. So there is more and more of a trend today with newer companies to move towards studying what is going to allow, with constraints, we're not going to replicate at home. However, even that trend of being up the opportunity for people to work from home and create their own schedules and work remote and then check in gives the opportunity for people in their own environment to excel when they're more self-propelled.
I like something that you said there about how the environment communicates things even when they're unsaid. I was visiting the campus recently of a multi-billion dollar electronics company, and they had in one area of a new building a prayer room with a foot washing station. And the anecdote that was relayed to me was that the CEO was touring the new facility and saw this and said, "What is that?" And somebody said, "Well, that's a prayer room with a foot washing station for Muslims to do their daily prayers." And the CEO said, "Well, I didn't know we had that. That's a fantastic idea. I'm so glad we have it. Do we have anyone using it now?" "Well, no, not yet. But we built it in because it communicates something about who we are."
And it's the concept of adapting diversity. And we do live in a diverse world today. And regardless of what someone's personal beliefs might be, the opportunity to embrace, to respect other cultures, to respect other belief systems is what opens up a company to be more successful because they are more inclusive rather than exclusive.
Yeah, we had a wonderful conversation in yesterday's show. Everybody should go listen when LT Ladino Bryson with vcandidates.com was here. Lisa Glenn Nobles from the Cahoots Foundation was here. And Robin Reed from the Black Chamber of Arizona was here. And Robin Reed made a very interesting point, which is that in today's world, diversity is table stakes. Having those folks in the room, in the building, in the organization is just the beginning. It doesn't mean you have inclusion. So it's diversity, then inclusion. I want to wrap up this little part of our conversation with a question about diversity and inclusion with regard to generations. There's a lot of conversation in the world now about millennials and Gen Z. And of course, my poor, sad, forgotten, disempowered, disaffected Generation X, right? The slacker generation, if you will. Does any of this labeling and stereotyping serve a valuable purpose, or is it something that we should all collectively knock off?
I believe it serves, and by the same token, disregard. And what I mean by that's actually one of the key topics in one of my keynotes that I provide for companies. And my take on it is a little different than most people. I also look at lineage, because when we're looking at millennials, most of the millennials, especially the older ones, baby boomers were their parents. Most of Gen Z, their parents were Generation X. You will find commonalities between the generations. And that being said, what does not change is human behavior, because we go through certain parts at our age. When we get out of school and we start work, we're all about, that's me, me, me. Doesn't matter whether you've been called the me generation as baby boomers or the me, me, me generation as millennials. When you get older, you look at creating a family. Then you look at creating a legacy. That's the trend of what we go through in our archetype in life. What's changed is the world around us. What's changed is the technology, the tools that we use. Therefore, we have to adapt to the environment that we're creating today. When I can pull up 3 white papers on Google in 20 seconds of typing something in, where in the past, when I was a kid, I had to go to a library and go through the Dewey Decimal System and open up encyclopedias, and it would take hours. Now I change the speed of productivity. Those are the things that we need to adapt to. Those are the things that we need to be aware when we're looking at the differences between generations. In companies, when we look at older generations, they'll have more life experience and more emotional intelligence and more skills very often because of what they've been through. But technical skills are going to come with the younger generation. Why not look at cross-connection and mentoring, where I can give something to you and you can give something to me, and now we collaborate?
Dr. Karen Jacobson, speaker and high-performance strategist. I'm sure we'll have more to say towards the end of this conversation. I'd like to bring Jeff Lynch into this discussion. Jeff, you're an attorney. You focus on estate planning and personal injury. Talk a little bit about the work you do at the law offices of Jeffrey D. Lynch.
Yeah, so the bread and butter of what I do is work with families to protect against the possibility of something happening to them. Most of the time we're talking about a car accident where someone is injured or passes away. And we look at all the possibilities. We make a plan around their family to make sure that their family is protected, whether that's with wills, powers of attorney, possibly with trusts, making sure life insurance is properly owned, so that if there is an unfortunate accident like that, that their family is protected.
Again, human beings, fascinating creatures. We live like we're never going to die, for the most part, and not just when we're young. The idea that somehow sudden tragic events could end our life doesn't enter into the consciousness of most people, as you can tell when you drive the freeways around Maricopa County. People live like they're invincible, and obviously they're not. By the same token, it's hard to get people to understand that actions they take today can protect them from unforeseen events in the future. What sort of conversations do you find yourself having with people on the proactive side of your practice to get them involved in your estate planning and other services?
Well, I think, like you said, the way that people drive, that's the number one cause of death for people in our generation. I think it's either accidents and unfortunately it's suicides as well. But we never know when it's going to happen. I think most of us know of that tragic story of someone who lost a parent or a friend of theirs who lost their lives in an accident. And this is something that when I'm speaking with my clients, I try to say things like, hopefully this is the worst money you'll ever spend. Hopefully we're going to do this. You're going to put it into a drawer and we're never going to need it. You're never going to be in an accident and in a hospital and somebody else is going to have to make a medical decision for you. You are not going to pass away until you're supposed to and you've lived a full life. But if you do, you've taken care of your family. And most people want that for their families. So it's not a hard connection to make.
That's a counterintuitive idea that this is the worst money you'll ever spend. You're asking people to spend money to do the preparation with the reassurance that this is as bad as it's going to get.
Yeah.
That's a counterintuitive concept, but I see where you're going with that. In your role as an estate planning attorney, you must enter into some of these multi-generational dynamics in a very real an everyday way. How does that play out?
It plays out in, there's a lot of my clients that are maybe in their 60s or 70s who are looking down the generation, and they specifically want to make sure that one of their grandchildren or one of their relatives is not going to be in charge of the money that they've made over their lifetime. They want to make sure that there's going to be someone who will watch over them because they can see that unfortunately in that younger generation, they're not making the decisions and they're not as financially sound as maybe the older generation was. Therefore, they want to make sure there's always a check and balance there. So we always set up trustees who the beneficiaries would need to come to a trustee and say, I need money for this particular purpose. And the trustee has the discretion to say, no, I don't think that that's a great idea. That's not what this trust was set up for. That's not what the goals of your parents or grandparents were. So it adds a layer of protection there.
One of the accusations leveled over the years at the baby boomers is that they've climbed to the top and pulled up the ladder. They haven't created the environments in which younger generations... Now, I'm not saying this is true. I'm just saying this is one of the things that is said. Do you find that as you're working both sides of that parent and child relationship, you find yourself as much of a family therapist as an attorney? How do you advise? Obviously, your client is the one with the money. How do you advise them and how to make those decisions in their own best interest?
The clients know it. I don't give them a set of things to go and think about. I ask them the question, and then whatever their gut reaction is, that's what it is. That's how they feel about, maybe it's their own child, maybe it's a couple of generations down. I have some clients where I say, you know, your son is Jimmy. If Jimmy was to inherit your money, Jimmy's 21 years old and you have life insurance plus equity in a home, maybe you have a business. So your total estate's worth $2 million. If Jimmy at 21 was to inherit the $2 million, how does that make you feel? Some parents will say, oh, that's not a problem. Jimmy's doing great. He's going to college. He's real responsible. And some look right at me and go, absolutely not. So then we just plan around that. We keep money inside of a trust until ages when they would be more responsible.
Now, there's perhaps a perception that this sort of estate planning and wealth management over the generations is something for wealthy families. Is that accurate, or is this really something that other folks ought to be looking at as well?
I think there's a misconception that it's only the ultra wealthy that need it. For a while, the focus on estate planning was estate tax avoidance. And that was because the estate tax exemptions historically have been rather low. Like in year 2000, I think they were about $675,000 per person. That was the estate tax exemption. So if somebody had a $2 million estate, they still had about a $1.3 million taxable estate at, I believe then it was like 45%. You're still looking at a $750,000 estate tax bill for somebody that was worth $2 million. Well, now it's $11 million or more than $11 million per person. So the estate tax avoidance isn't the focus. Now it's about protecting your children, maybe from themselves or any other nefarious characters, right? Unfortunately, we find that if someone, see, in the state of Arizona, let's say a couple of a child's parents pass away, they have some life insurance. Typically, that family could easily be worth $1 million if the child is young. At age 18, they would inherit whatever is left that hasn't been used. And statistics say that it's about $250,000 to raise a child from birth to age 18. So there could potentially be $750,000 to $1 million left over. At age 18, if there was a trust set up where there's a trustee who can overlook everything, you can keep the bad investments out. You can keep people from coming in and taking advantage of the child just for the money, because they have to go through a trustee in order to get to it.
This idea of protecting children from themselves and from unscrupulous people must be very attractive. And at the same time, you really need to have a candid conversation and get people to the place where they're able to think through some of these dynamics. How important is the conversation itself? This is not a check the box kind of a thing. There's no legal Zoom or whatever the app of the day is that could, sure, you can get a will from a software program, but there's a value add that you're bringing. It's not just your experience. It's the way you interact with people. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
There are questions that aren't posed on those kinds of apps of the day. It's not asked whether or not your beneficiary could potentially be the recipient of governmental benefits in the future. Those are things that need to be identified. Many of those kind of app of the day trusts will simply distribute the monies that are left in a trust to the beneficiaries at the age of 18, at the age of 21. There's no discretion there. There's no protections there. So when we're looking at like the value add of an attorney, it's that there are so many possibilities out there that a good questionnaire is going to start pointing me in the direction of what is the client concerned about and how do we alleviate that pain point for them.
What are some of those pitfalls? Life insurance or account beneficiary designation, there are some traps that some people could end up in without realizing it.
The first one I see is the client says, well, I have life insurance and I have a minor child, so I'm just going to leave the life insurance to my sister and my sister will take care of my kids, right? Well, if the client passes away, the money goes to the sister. If the sister ever has creditor problems, if the sister gets into a car accident and doesn't have enough insurance to cover it and ends up with a judgment against her, that life insurance can be used to pay off the judgment of the sister. So, you know, you say, okay, well, that's not a good idea. Let's just leave it directly to the minor child. Well, you do that, you're going to have to set up a conservatorship. You're going to have the court looking over it, accountings that need to be done, annual statements that need to be filed. So we say, all right, maybe that's not the best idea. So we look at it and say, it's probably best to have that inside of a trust where you can name who it is you want to be in control of the finances, in control of that money. And so we just kind of set the plan up around that. And then we work with the financial advisor to make sure that the life insurance is going where it needs to be.
Your personal journey into this world started early as you worked with your stepfather.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that and what you did and how that shaped the way you think.
Yeah, I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa. I actually went to the University of Iowa where I was the mascot. I certainly wasn't athletic enough to make any of the teams there. So I just put on a big fiberglass head and ran around. And then moved out here to Arizona. My mother and stepfather and I all moved out together. For the first year, I think I got it into my head that I was going to 10 bar at night and play golf every day and see if I could be a good golfer. So about a year later, my stepdad said, we didn't send you to college for you to be doing what you're doing. So he said, you're going to go down and get your insurance licenses. He was the life and investment specialist with Farm Bureau. He said, let's go. You're going to set appointments for me. We're going to go around and work with families here in Arizona, because Farm Bureau is actually out of Des Moines. My stepfather had been in the insurance business in Des Moines, Iowa for his entire career. So we traveled around the state working with farmers, ranchers, business owners, anybody who needed to address those kinds of situations, but we did it out in more rural communities.
Now take me into this scene for a second, because I'm visualizing this kind of movie playing out. You're out in rural Arizona, yep. Ranchland, Arizona.
Right.
And these two life insurance salesmen come rolling up in a cloud of dust as they bump along the highway and get out of the car and go up to the front door. How does that conversation unfold?
Actually, the way that it unfolded was that their property and casualty agent, who they had been with for 25 to 30 years, was in the back seat with us. So we always had a nice warm introduction with somebody that they had experience with, who they had been through claims with Farm Bureau. So there's that level of trust that was there. So when we were coming in, it gave us an opportunity to just, you know, have candid conversations about what's going on with your life, and are some of your children going to stay on the farm and are some are going to leave? And if so, do you want to treat them equally? Sometimes you have to have that conversation. Do you want to treat them equally? Because sometimes they'll say, no, the one that's staying on the farm, they're going to need more help than the other one who's excelling in school and looks like they're going to be a doctor. They won't need anything. And that's okay. That's okay to do.
How did that experience inform the conversations you now have in a less rural setting as you talk to folks here in Phoenix and the surrounding cities?
You know what it is that's one of the real commonalities that all people have. They work hard to set up their businesses, especially because I work with a lot of small business owners and kind of independent contractors, 1099 employees, things like that. It's really the same lines. They've worked very hard to build a business. They don't necessarily need to have their child in their business. They want their child to be able to express themselves in any way that they can. They just have this need to know that if something happens to them, everything's going to be all right, right? It's not a, this is just purely a fact of life, that it really doesn't matter what you believe. It's a possibility. It's something that happens. And if it does, these are the things that can go wrong, and these are the things that can go right. It's common through everybody. It's it. We live, we die. When we die, our assets go somewhere. There's no question about that. It's just a matter of who do you want to have them.
Yeah, I used to tell my students that one thing we know for sure, we can debate a lot of different statistics, but one thing we know for sure is that the mortality rate for human beings is 100%.
That's right.
So we know how the movie ends. We just don't know what was going on in the scene right before the final credits, right? And that's, in a way, we all get to write the future to the extent we take charge of it. What's a message you would want more small business owners to understand that would help them realize the importance, maybe even the urgency, of doing this kind of planning and preparation?
Really understanding the value of your business. You may be the one-person show. You're the CEO. You're making a lot of the decisions. You're making sure that orders are processed on time. But what you really do have and what you've built is a commodity that can be sold. And with the right plan in place and funding it correctly, if something were to happen to you, there's ways to make sure that someone else can be brought in to keep the business stable, maybe even grow the business a little bit while you have some time, maybe 3 to 5 years, to make that business as attractive as possible to be sold so that the proceeds can benefit your family. A lot of times there's the question of how do you replace someone's income, especially if you're a small business owner. And so a lot of times you look to life insurance, and that's a good place to look for it. But another thing to think about is, how do we make sure that that business doesn't fall apart, right? Because there's maybe 2 or 3 employees that they could just go out and start their own company and fill the orders that need to be filled. Well, instead of that scenario, let's set it up so that maybe we could hire somebody to come in to run the business so that it doesn't just crumble and your family gets nothing, that it's attractive enough that it can then be sold and your family gets something off of the work that you did to create that business.
Yeah, I imagine that succession planning for business owners has unique dynamics that just ordinary families don't necessarily have. In the old days, Farm Bureau days, you had that warm introduction from the property and casualty broker in the back seat. How do you develop relationships and networks of referrals and things to help support this kind of business? Obviously, the good word from, you know, happy clients goes a long way, but what sorts of avenues, in other words, what I'm really trying to say is, what does marketing a 21st century law practice look like?
Right. So right now, the focus in the last probably 3 years has been real estate agents. So my wife brilliantly joined the Women's Council of Realtors and became the strategic partnership chair there. And we work with a lot of title agents and loan officers who are looking to add value to their services. So they will bring us in to give a class. So I give a class on the basics of estate planning, wills, trusts, powers of attorney. And then I talk about limited liability companies for rental properties. And then I talk about PLLCs for real estate agents. And I just go over the basics of all of those, why they're important, how they can benefit not only the realtor, but the realtor's clients. So out of something like that, maybe I'll have a room of 20, maybe 1 or 2 of the realtors themselves will become clients. So that means maybe 90% of what I'm doing is just giving information to someone that they can take with them. Great. So I've given something to a potential client. They've got my card in their pocket. If something happens to them, I encourage everybody to give me a call because I don't charge for those initial consultations. I want to make sure people feel comfortable calling an attorney and not getting a bill for $16 because I said no within a couple of minutes. But in doing that, the realtors can then go to some of their clients that they have that they've done residual home buying for in the rental area. Rental properties have all been purchased into the client's name. That can be dangerous if there's a slip and fall, if there's a judgment of some kind. So then that client will call me because the realtor says, hey, you might want to look into something like this to protect your liability. So there's that's kind of how I open it up. And then from there, it's just kind of, hey, you know, X person told me to give you a call. This is the situation I'm in, which is why I ended up in personal injury and doing more of that.
And that's a new development in your practice. When did you start that and how has that unfolded?
I took my first case about a year and a half ago, and I partnered with a good friend of mine from law school, Gil Bernard, and then the attorney that he's been working with, Jaquees Blackwell. And, you know, Jaquees has got 15 years, I believe, of litigation experience, which I didn't have. So we've just worked on these cases together because why not? Why not develop another skill? Why not have another path where you can help the families and the clients? And it's been interesting. Like, there's one part of the law where you're working with families and creating documents and doing all of that stuff. But I know in my heart of hearts, the reason that I got into this was because I watched too much Law and Order. So I wanted to try to kind of fulfill that. And I found that with personal injury, you don't get into court very often. You end up settling a lot of it. So there's a lot of similarities between the two areas of law. But, you know, it's just always kind of striving to do something new. Like, I don't know, I got to a point in my life, I was like, I really want to get married. I want to have kids. You just feel these things. I want to try and do something new. And now I have a 3-year-old and a 10-month-old, and I'd give up the law just to be a dad if I could.
I love that. It's wonderful that you are covering both the reactive side in the personal injury law and the proactive side with the estate planning and business succession planning, and really helping people think through all the different forms of entities and contracts and all the stuff. I'm not a lawyer, but I read a lot of Perry Mason growing up.
Yeah. So,
Jeff Lynch, attorney at the law offices of Jeffrey D. Lynch. Thanks so much for being here and sharing some of your insights.
Thanks, Adrian.
Barney Davey, you have a fascinating backstory. You're a publisher, a business marketing coach, an artist. Tell us a little bit about your eclectic portfolio of experience.
I never planned to do any of it. It just kind of, I think you and I have had some conversations about this. I just gravitated toward things without a plan. I needed somebody like Jeff to maybe help steer me along.
I don't know. We might be a little too unruly for that sort of thing. Dr. Karen talked about serving in foreign military and working in ballroom dancer, competitive environments and all these things. You have a fascinating background as well. Soldier, firefighter, steel worker, teamster, ad agency owner, sales rep in the advertising business, and artist. But you don't strike me as the kind of bohemian with the beret. How did you get into art? Let's start there.
After the advertising agency experience, I went to work for a magazine publishing company in St. Louis. I'd been living in California for many years and oddly got a job working at a company in St. Louis where I grew up. So I went back home and worked for that company for 20 years. And they had a portfolio of magazines in the insurance, hospitality, home furnishings, art and retailing, picture framing retailing, private clubs. So I was calling on people in all kinds of various industries. And I really enjoyed that immensely because it meant that I didn't have to focus on one thing, which fits my lifestyle and persona, as we've just been discussing. But when I went to work for that company, I got there because I'd been working for an insurance company, an insurance magazine, and that's why they hired me. But when I went there and saw the publication called Decor that had 350 pages of advertising in the March issue, I was astounded at how this thing looked like a small city phone directory. And to me, as an ad salesman, that just looked like printing money. And that was my first experience in the CEO's office that day getting interviewed. And I went on to work there for nearly 20 years in that company and really fell in love with the art business during that time. Plus, I grew up as the son of a fine artist. Our home was full of books on practically every artist that you could name: Renoir, Degas, Van Gogh, Picasso. So I just had this steep experience, and all of a sudden, at nearly 40 years of age, I was brought back into the art business, something I'd loved and learned about as a child, and then now it's back in my life full time.
One of the things that you have specialized in, among many things, which I want to talk about, the digital marketing and some of the things someone wouldn't expect from a 71-year-old entrepreneur. You're not shy to tell people.
Not at all.
You have specialized in helping artists sell their art in some maybe not obvious to them ways. And you've written books about this as well. Talk about how you help folks sell art and how that plays out.
It's been an interesting, sometimes frustrating experience because artists aren't necessarily business-oriented to begin with. So there's a process of trying to educate them and encourage them and inspire them to that this is equally important as is making art if you want to embrace this as a business, something that is going to bring you full-time or even just serious part-time money. You need to be serious about that. I also have, I think, done a great service to many artists by explaining there's absolutely nothing wrong with being a hobbyist. I used to make fine woodworking and loved it and daydreamed about becoming a full-time fine woodworker until I looked at the economics of it and realized I'm making four times the money that I could possibly make. I'm not going to give up my lifestyle to become that bohemian artist. And having known that, it allowed me to then pass that along to other artists. And it's a great relief for them, but to know it's okay. I don't have to have those aspirations. I can say I just want to be a hobbyist. I'll tell them, go look on YouTube. There's 100 people who can play the guitar as well or better than Eric Clapton, but they've got a day job and they don't want all of the things that go along with making a career. But for those who do, what I'm trying to get through to now more than anything is that the previous two guests talked about it. It's a people business. People buy from the artist as much as they do the art. And you need to, this is what I need, what I'm explaining to artists these days is that you need to engage your potential buyers to let them know who you are, let them know what your thoughts are. What your thought processes were at the time you were making the art. When you can convey those kind of things with passion, that's how you sell art. And so my latest blog post was how to sell art without a website, email, or social media following. And it's, you start with your warm market, which is where we're going. I think that is the common thread I've seen. Heard in the conversation today.
For sure. And you started artmarketingnews.com, a blog and multimedia publishing platform, in 2005.
Right.
So you've been publishing weekly posts since 2005. What have you learned? Obviously, you'd written books and other things, but what have you learned from that discipline of online publishing that has helped you think differently about what's possible?
Well, it's been quite an evolution, really, from 2005 to now. It was eye-opening to become more immersed and understand what digital marketing was all about. And actually, as the more I got into it, the more I realized it still came back to what I just mentioned, and that is, it's all a matter of developing that levels of communication with somebody, levels of intimacy. And Ryan Dice, who's CEO of Digital Marketer, talks about developing levels of intimacy, that you can't just progress more than two steps past the 12 steps of intimacy in any kind of relationship, whether it's digital or personal, and expect to be successful.
Dr. Karen earlier made an important point that what we all have in common is that human equipment that we share, regardless of generation, nationality, linguistic background. There's something that connects us all. So it doesn't matter whether those conversations are happening at a remote farm or a business, you know, boardroom, or whether they're happening online or through a digital app culture, the smartphones that we now all have within arm's reach 24 hours a day and spend at least 6 of the hours we're on them looking at 5 apps on our phones. You've made a very interesting move over these years as you've developed competencies in some of the technical disciplines that lie at the heart of digital marketing. You also provide some of those things as a service. How do you help people with an idea or a course or a book or any of the other kinds of products? How do you help them get their body of work out to the world?
Well, the books and blog were the first part. Then I started doing public speaking, excuse me. And then I have evolved into online course creation because that was the obvious thing that I realized myself, starting with myself, I would get a book, read it cover to cover, and take copious notes and have all these plans and then maybe do 5 or 10% of what I'd thought I was going to do after reading the book. So I thought the next thing would be to, an online course is really kind of like a living book that, and you can go much deeper and get more involved with people. So I started doing online courses, and to take that a step further, that works better than a book, but there's still limitations to it because you're still requiring people to have determination and the grit to stick with things, even if it's a subject matter that they're particularly interested in, but it will be helpful to them. So I've now layered in adding personal coaching for artists who want to have somebody. It's more of an accountability thing than anything else. Just somebody who's not your spouse. That's what I always say. You can't have your spouse be an accountability partner. They're already accountable to you, and you're already accountable to them for way too much to expect them to now be accountable for your business. So that is the latest thing I'm trying to do, and get them more, teach them more about digital marketing so that they can understand. It's a foreign concept. Something like marketing automation to artists is, you might as well have just flown in on a you come in from outer space when you start talking to them about some of these concepts. But when you get through to them, they understand this could actually make my life easier. I could sell more art without doing more work.
A few minutes ago, you hinted that some of your work with artists was frustrating, but I'm sure it's also deeply satisfying. Can you speak to both sides of that emotional arc for yourself? What do you love about working with artists, and what's been frustrating?
I love working with artists because they're so creative, and it's unending when they get inspired about something and start actually taking off and doing it. That, to me, is so gratifying and rewarding, especially when I get feedback that I tried these things and they actually work, and you're changing my life. And the flip side of that is that no matter how hard I work or how passionate I present or eloquently I tell a story, it's still very frustrating to realize that I can't motivate some of these people to help them help themselves. And that part of it is a little bit discouraging. It's like, I put in an awful lot of time to create this course. You've bought it, you've paid me money, and you're not fulfilling, you're not doing good by yourself by not going through the course.
Barney, before we open this up, and there's some really interesting points of overlap I want to explore. You all may have some questions or thoughts for each other as well. You have a new venture, which you've been cooking up. We were talking about this a number of months ago, and you told me you'd done it. You have registered boomers.biz. This idea of the silverpreneur, the second or third or fourth act, developing a hobby into a viable business that somebody can do post-retirement, whatever that means anymore, probably nothing. What is your vision for the future of how you're going to help the silverpreneur, the boomer in business?
It's been an evolution, and the reason it's taken me a while is I really wanted to cogitate on it and not just rush to market, because I have the other business that I'm not planning on leaving the art business. I'm just planning on expanding what I'm doing. And I realized a long time ago, much of what I teach is applicable across the board to practically anybody, any entrepreneur for certain. And I looked at myself and realized that I came into this rather relatively late at life. I'm, as you mentioned, 71. So when I started Art Marketing News. I was, must have been 56 years old, even at that time, pretty close to, you know, fairly close to retirement at that age. And I since learned that 10,000 baby boomers a day are retiring. And I know that a lot of them have something like me. I had specialized knowledge about the art print market that got me launched into writing books and doing workshops. And again, no plan, just happened. I got invited to do a six-hour workshop on how to get into the print market at the Sedona Art Center, and that led me to 90 pages of speaker notes, and I thought I should make an ebook, but when I got it finished, it was 300 pages, so I published a paperback book, and that kind of just launched me. But I realized there's other people walking around with this highly specialized knowledge or passionate about something, and they want to share that in some way. Or they're just creative in some other way. So I don't even want to limit it to just passion, just creative. So the tagline for boomers.biz is launchpad for creative encore careers. And the way I'd envision it now is it's not just me. I want to find everyone else who's doing similar things, whether it's coaching or they've got apps or services or software that would help silverpreneurs to get themselves into business as easily as possible. And with my experience in digital marketing, what I'm constantly in trying to do is what's the easiest frictionless way to get this done? Like I've moved to the Teachable platform, which is an all-encompassing online course because I was tired of dealing with WordPress and databases and security and plugins and updates and on and on and on. I know how to do all that stuff. I managed to also, we didn't even cover this, work 6 years at GoDaddy in the tech and sales support department. So I've got this tech side, but I can do this. I know most people my age would just flip out at trying to think about this. So what are the easy ways how to do this?
Well, and the beauty of the way things are headed is that apps are getting more powerful and more simple at the same time. The way we used to have to bolt together so many things to build a membership site that allowed people to have a password-protected login and get regular updates and drip out the content over time and shut off their access if their PayPal payment, their subscription doesn't go through. The amount of complexity that used to be there is still there if you want it, but it's no longer necessary.
And that's what I'm with this launchpad. I'm looking to identify people, processes, and systems that I can then say to you, whether you want to write a book, become a public speaker, become an artist, you want to become some kind of a coach, what do you want to do with your life post-retirement? Here are my services, and here's an array of other people's services and products that I have personally vetted that I would recommend to you to look into to help you in your post-retirement career, your encore career.
Jeff, I'm curious if this sort of thing ever comes up in your discussions or comes across your radar. Do you find folks in their 60s and 70s who have what the kids call a side hustle? Are there people who are interested or are actively pursuing some sort of biz hobby in their golden years?
Yeah, it usually starts off with the comment of, well, I can only play so much golf. And then now what am I supposed to do? So I really like the idea of streamlining it for that retired person to give them an opportunity to dedicate some time. They're not trying to create, a global business here. They're just trying to use their energy productively, maybe make a little bit more as they go in through retirement. Who doesn't like to have a little bit more money? It's like my grandmother is 93. She lives kind of close to us over here, and she worked at an escrow company until she was about 80, and it kept her real sharp. And having that thing to do every day and those things to read. And I think it's extremely beneficial, not just on a monetary standpoint, but from an overall health and wellness perspective. That's a great idea.
And if there's 13-year-olds making $400,000 a year selling slime on Instagram, and there's no reason why a seasoned professional in the later years of her life can't be doing something as significant. Dr. Karen Jacobson, you've been scribbling some notes and listening to this conversation, what questions or interactions do you have for these gentlemen here?
Well, the first thing relates to the idea of the baby boomers. It's not just the aspect of the fact that, you know, somebody might want to have a side hustle because of the fact that they're looking for a sense of purpose, because when you lose your purpose, you lose your life. But the other aspect is the baby boomer generation is the generation that was all about he or she who has more toys wins. Some of them are not actually able to retire. Some of them still have to work in order to pay off debts for the fact that they've put three or four kids through college because of the fact that they have created certain aspects of building business and providing for their family. So now they have to pay off and they've got credit cards to pay off. But there's always been, when I had my previous career as a chiropractor and I would look at people that were retired and those that were more viable and were sharper, were more connected, it was about those people that had a sense of purpose in their life and did something to give back and contribute to the community. Now, for some, it might have been the opportunity because they did not need the extra financial incentive or
the benefit.
The benefit.
Yeah.
And they went out and they volunteered. But there were many of those that they just said, I still might need to work. I still also would like to contribute to the world. It's just in a different format. It might not be to go for a 9-to-5 corporate job. I've had patients who became consultants, took their skill sets and just work on their own schedule, on their own time. So the concept of entrepreneur really had evolved to a different level where now you do have the retired, semi-retired, or second act or third act type of business person. And when we look at health and benefits of longevity, of mindset, of sharp skills, I mean, my dad, who's beyond a baby boomer, my dad's going to be 89 years old. He teaches 13 fitness classes a week. And he works with people who are younger than him and who are older than him. And when you look at him, you would have no idea that he's in his late 80s, pushing 90. And he's passionate about life. He's an entrepreneur, has always been. He's an artist and an entrepreneur and has always been. And one of the things that I find, it goes back to the core of who we are as human beings and how we create value in our lives for ourselves and for the people around us.
Dr. Karen Jacobson, thank you very much for being with us today. Where do people connect with you, find out more, hire you, et cetera? Where do folks find you online?
I am everywhere online. I've got anywhere from my website to my Facebook to my Twitter to my LinkedIn to Instagram. They're all branded under Dr. Karen Jacobson with an S-O-N.
Great. Thanks very much for being here. Jeff Lynch, attorney, the law offices of Jeffrey D. Lynch. You help people with catastrophic events in their life, preventing them and reacting to them. Where do people learn more and how do they connect with you and attend maybe one of those classes?
Sure. So you can look me up on Facebook. I do have a webpage, website that is jdlynchlaw.com. And all of the same platforms that Dr. Karen was just talking about. I believe I have all of those. I'm not great on Instagram and Twitter, but best place to go would be to the web, look up my name, Jeffrey D. Lynch or jdlynchlaw.com, email me, give us a call, and you'll get through to me.
Great. And Barney Davey, publisher of Art Marketing News and multifaceted entrepreneur, where's the best place for people to connect with you?
You can go to barneydavey.com. or artmarketingnews.com, or look me up on Facebook. My Facebook page is facebook.com/careering.
Marvelous. Thank you all for being here. I hear the landscape crews right outside our window. It means it's time for us to wrap up this show. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.